I'm often accused of being a dreamer, but what people sometimes don't recognize is the dedication and perseverance it took to make my dreams reality.
Howard Baldwin started as a minor league ticket counter and steadily worked his way up, eventually becoming a founding owner in the World Hockey Association, or WHA. Known as the Rebel League, the WHA was responsible for forcing the NHL out of its medieval stupor. In time, the two leagues would come together. Howard would play a crucial role in overseeing that merger in ending hockey's seven-year war. But during those 7 years, the League of the Outlaws put out seven great seasons of hockey. Among the teams, none would match the sustained success of Howard's. Essentially born out of a bluff, his New England Whalers were crowned WHA champions in the league's inaugural season. The Avco World Trophy would be far from the last piece of championship hardware Howard hoisted above his head. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves, because the path to that historic night in 1973, the entire path Howard took, was anything but straightforward. Nothing would ever be given. Everything would have to be earned. And he knew it, too. It's a journey that's hard to believe, especially considering that just months prior to the puck dropping on that first season, the Whalers were nothing more than an idea, a dream. At the time, one of Boston's leading sports columnists wrote that the chances of the 20-something-year-old successfully establishing a WHA team in New England were, quote, slim and none. After all, founding a professional hockey franchise requires an arena, players, and money. Howard had none of the three. But he had ambition. He wasn't afraid to dream.
To be accused of being a dreamer really isn't such a bad thing, so long as you're willing to work hard, to persevere. This is the story of what it took to make my dreams come true.
Previously on Slim and None.
So he had us on skates when, practically when, at the same time we started walking. I remember being on double runners back there in Mount Kisco, just skating on the driveway. I was a rotten student and proud of it, I guess. You couldn't help but have a sort of a chip on your shoulder. You felt, God, how do you measure up? And that's what I did. I really did think out of the box from the time I left prep school. I didn't go to college, I went to the Marines. When I came out, I really didn't know what to do, but I liked Boston, and I had friends at Harvard, and I figured I'll go to BU. And if I couldn't be on the field or on the ice, I wanted to try to figure out something off the ice. And that's what I did. And he said, come on down. I have a position for you with the minor league team we just bought. And I just said, no questions asked. I'm on my way. And that's what I did.
On a hot, humid day in the summer of 1966, Howard arrived in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, for his first day on the job. He hoped his future in hockey, if there was one to be had, would be 8 miles to the northwest with the Philadelphia Flyers when they started in the NHL. If he wanted to make it there, though, first the 24-year-old would have to prove himself to the Devil's ownership.
So when I went down to the Jersey Devils, I had no idea what it entailed. Just no idea. You know, I mean, who's kidding who? I just had nothing but enthusiasm and desire. I was no more ready to get into a business situation, but they gave me the chance. And I went off from there. And I loved it. If you asked me what my favorite year of hockey was, I'd have to tell you that first year was just so much fun. It was like a kid in a candy store. Here I am with a professional hockey team, albeit, and I wasn't even as familiar with the world of professional hockey. I wasn't that familiar with it, but the East Coast Hockey League, and I was pro. And I just figured this is the greatest opportunity of a lifetime. I'm just going to get in here and do what I can with it.
Money was an afterthought. Howard was just happy to be involved.
I can tell you I made for the year, I got paid at the rate of like $6,000 or $6,500 for the year. But it was season, so it was plenty. Everything was so cheap then. It was fine. They could have paid me, well, not nothing, but Not much. Let's just leave it like that. Not much.
Even by today's standards, it wasn't much, especially considering all his varied responsibilities.
Sell tickets, sell advertising, get the program printed. Everything a front office does today, now they have 200 people. Get the programs, make sure they're printed, ready to go, deal with whatever little media we had. Line up, make sure the trips were planned for the team when I went on the road. I was a one-man band. I did anything and everything I was asked to do and loved every second of it. It was learning. And I tell people today it was like my college, getting my college, degree. Because I learned on the fly, on the job. I love to work. I mean, I love being busy.
He loved it because he was used to it. Working hard was what he had always done.
Like most of the people we went to private school with had more money than we did. We all had to go to work, summer jobs and whatnot, from 13 or 14 on.
In the summers, my brothers and I always had summer jobs. One summer I worked in Wyoming on a cattle ranch. Doing what I did in the summers gave me a sense of responsibility.
And we were put to work on the place too. I mean, we'd joke amongst ourselves, holy shit, we got to do lawns and this, that, and the other this weekend. God, I dread these weekends. The background wasn't all privilege, okay? It was privileged, but it wasn't just privileged. It had other layers to it. He came from people who were very fortunate and from the point of view of educational opportunity, unsurpassed. But there was this whole thing of in the family of everyone has to work.
And the boys were better because of it.
My father had to work hard. My parents had, they didn't inherit any money. Dad had a lot of difficulties in figuring out what he really wanted to do. And he wasn't a fulfilled person in his work. And that made work very important for the four of us to figure out what is it, we want to do and let's do it. And I think Howdy was, if anything, he understood that earlier than any of the others of us. I think he knew from a very early age he wanted to be in sports and that was where he had the best chance of expressing himself.
Because that precedent had been set so early on, Howard developed an ethic few could rival.
And he had to work his butt off. Yeah. He wasn't afraid of working hard. Uh-uh. He's a little bit of a workaholic.
And I knew I had to try a little harder because I didn't have academic skills. So you really try hard to be personable and create a likability factor so that all things being equal, people might want to deal with me. And with Bill Putnam, I guess I struck that chord with him.
Howard remembers the first time he saw the Devils' home stadium.
First time I went in there, I said, this place is the greatest arena I've ever been in. And as a kid, I grew up going into Madison Square Garden. So I had been into, a major league quote unquote arena before, but this was going to be my building. So I thought it was, 4,500, 5,000 seats. I kind of forget what it had. Press box was this horrible little gondola. And yet I loved it. I loved it. And now coming back to it later, I realized this had to be one of the great arena dumps in the world. But then it was good.
On the back end, the front office was not a very crowded one.
And it was me and a young lady who was like an office manager and a coach who was a pretty well-known NHL player at the time, Vic Stasiak, who hadn't arrived on the scene yet. So it was just me and this young lady and a consultant named Stu Nahan, who was the NFL voice of the Eagles and the NFL game of the week. It was really us. My title was operations manager.
Vic and Howard quickly bonded over their mutual love for the game.
Vic Stasiak was a well-known name. And so when he came to town, he had a wife and four kids, but he left them in Lethbridge, Canada, and he ended up batching with me in an apartment. We just had a great time together. He ate, slept, and drank hockey. So if we didn't have a game of our own, he was always looking for a game to go to. We actually, one night, the Red Wings came to Madison Square Garden, and he worshipped Gordie Howe, and he played with Gordie. And he said, we got to go up to Madison Square Garden. It was no big deal. It's driving up the Mass Pike, or the Jersey Turnpike. He says, we got to go to the game, and he got the tickets from the Red Wings. But I was the one that drove him everywhere in my car. I had a car, but my car was broken down or something. He says, don't worry. We'll take the team bus. I said, Vic, we can't be driving the team bus, you and me, into Madison Square Garden. And he said, we're doing it. So it was this little old crappy red school bus that had bunks built into it and everything. And we go up the Jersey Turnpike. I don't know where the hell we parked the thing. And went to the game, met Gordie Howe after, and drove the bus back. I mean, it was fun. It was, imagine, I felt I'd died and gone to heaven, you know, being able to do all this stuff.
That season with the Devils was an eventful one, to say the least.
You know, one week, I actually coached the team for a week, which was interesting, because Vic had bought this golf club in Lethbridge, and he didn't want the Flyers, who were really overseeing the operation, to know that he left the team to go and close on this land. Now, we had no game. It was just practice. So he said to me, run the practice. And he gave me the little piece of paper with everything on it. And so, you know, I didn't look out of place skating around the ice with these guys, or I wouldn't have played in the game with them. And we had some tough guys on that team. And this fellow, Reggie Meserve, he had been in so many fights that his hand had been broken so many times that when the surgeon fixed it, he did set it in such a way so that a hockey stick he'd be able to hold a hockey stick, but he couldn't open his hand. I swear to God. And so at the end, I look at my notes that Vic had written out for me to have these guys do, and it said wind sprints. You know, and because who likes wind sprints? So I said, all right, everybody on the line, they do the wind sprints, up, down, and I'm about to blow it again, and Reggie comes up and takes the stick and whacks me in the ass and says, we've done enough for the day, Howard. Let's go home. And I said, good, Reggie. Let's do it.
And so home they went. A good night's rest was vital given the team's upcoming schedule.
We had a big game Friday night with our rival, the Clinton team. And now the general manager of the Flyers got wind of the fact that Vic had gone back to Lethbridge. So he called up and he says, you know, Howard, where's Vic? And he knew he wasn't there. I think he was testing me. He said, where's Vic? I need to talk to him. And I said, well, he's not here right now, bud. And he says, Howard, where is he? Well, I had to tell him the truth because I would have been doomed. I said, look, he went off. He had to do something, but he's coming back tomorrow. He'll be there to coach. He said, he better be. Of course, Friday is a blinding snowstorm. You know, and, you know, no planes are coming in. So I called up Bud and I said, you know, Bud, doesn't look like Vic's going to make it. And he said, you two assholes cooked up this plan. You coach the team for the game. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, there's just no way I can do that. And thank God Vic got in at about an hour before game time and we played the game.
The East Coast Hockey League was notorious for its physical play.
You've seen the movie Slapshot? That's what the league was. I mean, the first game, first exhibition game, I'm in there counting tickets, and I hear screaming and yelling out in there. I said, oh, my God, somebody. And I go out. Every player is on the ice. Some of the fans are on the ice. I mean, it was mayhem, and that's the way that league was. I mean, there was one practice or one game at the end of the game. Lorne O'Donnell, I remember like this, excuse me, stuff like this. And Lorne, in those days, you didn't have a guard on the back of the skate. And so he went up in the air and he fell on his mouth, went right on the back of the skate. Just awful. And all his teeth, his lower teeth came out. And so I go into the locker room and Vic Stasiak said, Howard, go on the ice and find his teeth. We got to find his teeth. So I go on the ice. I found his teeth. I did find him. Everything that we saw in Slapshot was exactly the way that league was.
At the end of the season, the Devils found themselves second place in the Northern Division. They were playoff bound.
It was the first round of the playoffs. And again, the game that's the team, if you remember, Slapshot was the Johnstown Jets. They changed the name to the Chiefs, but it was the Jets then. And again, there was a rough, rough game. It was the final of a 3 out of 5, and it was the final game, and nobody ever thought we'd win the game. Well, we did win it. At the end of the game, one of the players flipped the puck into the stands to do a nice thing. He didn't shoot it. He flipped it. But it happened to hit the secretary of the owner in the mouth and, you know, cut her pretty good. She just was looking the wrong way. So we're in the locker room, and there are fans mobbed outside trying to get to whoever flipped the puck, and they thought it was Normie Defilus, who was a famous East Coast League player, great guy, had a terrible foul mouth. And we knew the cops were coming. And so Stu Nahan, the consultant I told you about, said, let's get Normie with his pads on and everything. There was a little window. We snuck through. We got Normie out of the window. And out the back way where Stu had his Cadillac, because he had driven into the game, put Normie in the trunk and started heading back to Philadelphia. And as we're leaving that building, the cops, there was 6 or 7 cop cars coming. They were going to arrest him and bring him in. So we made it. We got out of Dodge.
After taking down the Jets and winning their following series, the Devils were championship bound.
We made the finals. We made the finals, and we played the Nashville Dixie Flyers, who had a couple of, they had some good players. But anyway, they beat us 4-1. And that's how it ended. Yeah, I was thrilled with the way the team did. So were the Flyers and the owners. They were very pleased. And when the season ended with the Devils, my job ended. And, you know, the Flyers weren't ready to hire me. Bill Putnam said, we're not quite ready yet. Go on home and I'll give you a call. And he gave me a call around August to do the ticket manager job. So I was, you know, I was nervous. I was hoping like heck they'd bring me back. And they did.
Howard crammed in all 4 years of his hockey undergraduate into one season with the Devils. He earned his MBA with the Flyers. Ed Snyder, one of the Flyers' owners, brought in another fellow, Lou, to work alongside Howard in the front office.
Well, Lou was there from day one. Lou was like Eddie's sort of right-hand man. And PR guy, slick PR guy.
All right, I'm Lou Scheinfeld, what they call a legend in Philadelphia. I prefer icon, but the legend is okay. That's not what my wife calls me, but we won't go into that. And I was a hotshot reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, covering City Hall politics. And I loved it. It was fantastic. And I take this job in this startup hockey thing, and people thought I was crazy.
Much like the Devils, in Philadelphia, nothing came easy.
Well, it was a tough sell.
And selling hockey in a non-hockey town wasn't easy, but that was my job. So I would call people on the phone for season tickets or for sponsorship. And I would say, hi, this is Lou Scheinfeld from the Flyers. And they go, Flyers? You mean Breyers? Breyers Ice Cream? Who is Friars? What are Flyers? I explained the whole thing. And this one person said, soccer will never go over in Philadelphia. I said, I'm talking hockey.
Look, our season ticket base the first year was 1,200 season tickets. The gross gate at our first game was $13,000. And the gross gate for the whole year was $750,000. I remember all that kind of stuff because I was a ticket manager. I had to know that. Now, those were the days when you had what they call hard tickets. You know what I mean? You know what a hard ticket is, right? Something you hold in your hand. And it gives you a seat location. That's the way tickets were sold then. And that in itself was a huge challenge because I had no background in that. It's really an accounting function. But I had to manage the process of the accounting of the tickets when you made a sale, getting the money in the bank, getting the person's seat, a seat location, all of that, and then manage the salespeople. I had no problem keeping up with it, but it was a full-time. There was no eight-hour-a-day job.
To be a box office manager, you have to be a mathematician. You have to be honest. You have to be detail-conscious. He was all of those. So like Howard said, that first year, we had 9 employees in the whole organization other than the players. And now there's almost 300 employees at the Philadelphia Flyers. Look, we didn't have focus groups. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers. We didn't have that thing called analytics, you know. So it was crazy.
The craziness reached its peak right before puck drop.
Tough job, especially night of game. All these people lined up outside, ticket mix-ups, counterfeit tickets. all kinds of things can go wrong. And some box office managers succumb to the pressure. But Howard was cool. He's a cool guy. Howard kept everything together.
And it's a good thing he did.
I mean, that first few years for those guys had to be scary. And you didn't have much income coming from anywhere else in those days. Television, radio was barely a break-even proposition.
It got to the point where management was more concerned with having bodies in the seats than they were with selling tickets.
Well, we had one of the owners, Joe Scott, and so he knew all the bars and all, and he'd go in there and hand out pocket schedules and tickets. His idea was, okay, if we give a couple of thousand tickets away a game, it introduces people to the product, and if they like the product, they'll come back and buy. Now, there are those that disagree with that. I didn't think it was such a bad idea. But there are those that think if you give something away for free, you're going to expect to get it free every time. And I think what Joe did was way more good than harmful, way more good, because he exposed a lot of people to the product. Hockey, you have to see it live in order to like it.
As Joe suspected, the people who saw it liked it.
The first time we all knew we had something really good going was, and I remember the dates, as a ticket manager, you remember like this, but the February 3rd, February 4th, Friday, Saturday, Toronto, Chicago, and they're both sold out. And I think that gave Ed and Bill and the guys, the owners, a huge lift knowing the market's there. Every year, season tickets went up and the fan base went up.
Howard had a hand in exposing Philadelphia to professional hockey, but the Spectrum Arena was exposing much more than that.
I remember coming into the building and I see all the cops and everything. And this fella who worked in the front office, Kenny Blackburn, a great old guy, said, Howard, you're not going to believe it. The mayor and everybody's up on the roof. I said, what are they doing on the roof? Well, it blew off and it was really like, it was crazy. It was like tar paper. He said, come on in. We go into the floor of the Spectrum. And I look up at the sky and you could see blue sky.
In the 3.5 years he spent with the Flyers, the organization grew, as did Howard and his reputation.
Came in early, rarely ever went to lunch, and stayed late. So he had the work habit. He had the ethic. And that rubbed off on his staff and to other people in the organization. That's one thing I always remembered about Howard. While he was Mr. Nice Guy, he was also very competitive, yes. And not in a nasty way or not in a cruel way like some people are. But you just knew, you don't mess with Howard Baldwin. He's a nice guy, but I wouldn't rub him the wrong way. I never saw it, but I know that he would tell his staff to straighten up. Why is that ticket on the floor? That's $50. That's a $50 bill laying down there. It's not a piece of cardboard. You know, you get used to working with all these tickets, and it's cardboard. You know, it's paper. No, it's not. Every one of those is a $50 bill.
When sales manager was added to his job description, Howard was given the opportunity to work more closely with Ed Snyder. Ed included him in the sales and marketing decisions, which was great because Howard thirsted for that knowledge. It was like studying for a PhD in hockey ownership.
Eddie ended up being one of my closest, dearest friends. But Eddie really would work.
Yeah, I mean, nobody worked harder at the Flyers and Spectrum than Ed Snyder. I've never been with anybody in my life like Ed Snyder who rolled up his sleeves and worked alongside of you.
But Eddie was a majority owner, and he'd come snag me out of that ticket office, and he'd say, come on, let's go up and walk the building and look for ways we can add seats.
Together, Eddie and Howard traversed the entirety of the Spectrum. They took their time, looking into what the impacts of even the smallest of changes would be before making any decisions. That was the way things were done with the Flyers, the right way. Howard was learning a lot and loving every second of it.
I mean, I met some great people there. I mean, I met, because my ticket office had a Dutch Bay door to it, right? And you had to go right by the ticket office to get to the executive office and to get to the locker rooms. So I became kind of a stopping place for not only our own players, but people like Wilt Chamberlain, some Bobby Orr would always stop, Gordy, you know. So it was a big thrill for me.
He would lean on the counter into the hallway looking for customers and always had a smile on his face. And he was always there, leaning, looking out. So he was like the face you saw before you got to the Flyers' office. And he put on a good face.
I also worked late hours. And so one night I heard somebody out there on the floor, they had they called the Philadelphia Indoors, National Indoors or something like that. Big tennis tournament for women. And I go out on, and Vic was with me, Stasiak, because he then was getting ready to, he was working with the Flyers. And there's Althea Gibson, famous tennis player, hitting him back to her. And I wasn't a bad tennis player, so I said, you know, Miss Gibson or whatever I called her, would you like me to hit them back to you? And she said, oh, sure, honey, that'd be great. And I thought, well, I'll show her. Well, let me tell you something. That ball came at me, it seemed like 100 miles an hour. It was humiliating, but I ended up having pretty good fun.
By June of 1970, Bill had sold his stock and was gone from the Flyers. Howard wouldn't be far behind him.
I don't know how to explain it. I just felt instinctively, you know, I just figured if I stay here, I'm going to be doing this for the next 20 years. And somehow I've got to find a way to do more. And that's why I left.
It was not until he was gone that it became apparent just how vital a piece of the Flyers organization Howard had become.
And after he left, the box office fell apart. And we were 3 weeks before opening game, like in our fifth season. And we might have had, 2,000 or 3,000 season ticket holders and a couple thousand more plan holders. And 3 weeks before the season opens, the tickets are all messed up. And we asked the box office, why aren't the tickets being sent out? Oh, well, Ed Snyder and I went into the box office, and they're all over the floor. 40 home games, well, 37 then, plus preseason, times 15,000 seats is a lot of tickets. But they were all over the place. These guys didn't know what they were doing after Howard left.
While some took more kindly to Howard's decision than others, the only perspective that really mattered to him was his own.
It's just something I had to do. And I knew that people were saying, what the heck is he thinking? But I still did it. My gut tells me I have to do this. And so people were polite and respectful about it, though my father said that it was a bad decision, but my brothers didn't say it too much, or maybe behind my back they did.
You have to take a chance in life. And Howard took a chance.
Chance was one word for it. There wasn't much of a plan in place.
I was just going to wing it. I was going to find a job in the Boston area where I wanted to be and try to find a job in sports. I mean, I was on my own, you know, trying to land on my feet, you know.
The aha moment came during a drive with Bill Henderson, a fellow former sales associate with the Flyers.
But we were going over over the Walt Whitman Bridge saying, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I said, one day I want to own my own team. That's my goal. That's my ambition.
It was quite the aspiration. But Howard's ambitions had always exceeded the status quo. It's a testament to the way that he was raised.
I would say probably our mother instilled a sense of ambition in all of us. If I had to put my finger on it. He's ambitious. He's ambitious, but he's ambitious. And he's done a lot, as you know. I mean, very few people, and I think he probably has pointed this out to you, but at any rate, very few people have, you know, done an Oscar-winning film and also walked away with the Stanley Cup. Not many people do that in two totally different professions.
Driving over the Whitman Bridge, Oscars and Stanley Cups could not have been more than a pipe dream. And anyways, there were more pressing matters to attend to, like the look of disbelief on Bill's face. Howard recognized that stare. He had gotten the same one from Bob Meyer almost a decade prior.
Well, it was interesting when we went on this little one-week journey together after our military days, if you will. He and I would talk about our dreams and aspirations, and a lot of times we'd be playing catch because I was getting ready for spring training, and I'd be telling him what I hope to achieve in the next year or two or whatever, and he would continually tell me that he wanted to own a hockey franchise. I found that very endearing and inspiring. You know, those were rather ambitious and unusual goals. And I never said anything to him specifically, like, are you crazy? Or, you know, that's absurd. Or, you know, you're a 19-year-old kid. How the hell are you going to do that? I never came up with any of that, but I was thinking it. I just couldn't comprehend how a kid that was about my age, a little younger even, could comprehend that, desire that type of thing.
That neither Bill nor Bob took him seriously didn't bother Howard. He was a dreamer. He was an opportunist. But above all, he was ambitious. He was not afraid to work hard because he knew that's precisely what it would take to turn the impossible into reality. Which brings us to a typical weekend morning in the spring of 1971. 6 months since Howard had left the Flyers. He was getting ready for the day ahead in the back office of a clothing store he had recently started working at with an old friend, Johnny Coburn. The store was supposed to be a temporary stop as he worked out his next move, but each day it became less and less temporary.
It was a worrisome time. No, I wouldn't say I was scared, but I was, you know, you get a pit in your stomach because, you know, you realize once you get out of the business, it's not easy to get back in. Even to this day, it's a hard business to get in.
Expenses were mounting every day, and he had the feeling time was running out. His thoughts were jumbled. He could barely focus on the newspaper he was leafing through. His mind was elsewhere. That's when it caught his eye.
I remember where I was sitting. I remember the Globe. In fact, now they have these archives and everything. I could probably find a little. It was, you know, these the papers have like a little thing called a sports log, where you have these little mini stories. So it was really not even a, you know, like a. It was just a mini little story where World Hockey Association formed and announced, and applicants are coming in. The founders were Gary Davidson, Dennis Murphy, who started the ABA, offices in West Coast, MacArthur Boulevard, Orange County. So we dialed them up blind, right there on the spot. And thus began the hustle.